Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Today, a conversation about reforms to the juvenile justice system that the Maryland General Assembly has been working on this session. In 2022, lawmakers passed two measures, one called Juvenile Justice Reform and the other called the Child Interrogation Protection Act. At the beginning of this month, the House and Senate each overwhelmingly passed separate bills that address concerns about holding young offenders accountable and rehabilitating them when they commit crimes. A little later in the program, I'll speak with Judge Andre Davis, who served on four courts over a 30-year career and who also served as the city solicitor for Baltimore during the administration of Catherine Pugh. But we begin with Delegate Luke Klippinger, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. Chairman Klippinger joined me on Zoom a little earlier this morning. Mr. Chairman, welcome. It's good to talk to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. So why now for a revisiting of juvenile justice statutes in Maryland?
So we were asked, my committee was asked by the speaker in the summer after the shooting in Brooklyn, in my district. The speaker asked us to review what we did with the Juvenile Justice Reform Act in 2022. And so we did. We had three briefings over the summer and into the fall about different aspects of the act. And we talked to people on literally every side of the issue, from some of the people advocating for reform and further reform, and members of law enforcement who had concerns about the existing structure. And so apart from that, I had also been hearing from people in the judiciary and other places who had indicated some concerns about the existing structure. So we took that information, and I and Senator Smith, along with the Speaker and the Senate President, put together a set of proposals that would put some guardrails around the system that was created in 2022. And would allow for better oversight over the juvenile system.
And the laws that were passed in 2022, the Juvenile Justice Reform Act and the Child Interrogation Protection Act, do they change at all under the proposals that's either the one in the House or the Senate?
The Interrogation Act does not. And I don't believe the Senate makes changes to that legislation either. The JJRA would change in some ways, with the eye being towards looking at juveniles who were on probation. They had already been found to be delinquent, which is the juvenile equivalent of being found guilty in an adult court. They were found to be delinquent, they were placed on probation, and they committed a further crime than on probation. That was one universe of people. And then the other universe of people who were touched by this were 10 to 12 year olds. It's a genuinely a smaller universe of people, but there were misdemeanors that we felt were serious enough where there needed to be DJS supervision, as opposed to, as we were discovering, no supervision at all.
DJS, of course, the Department of Juvenile Services. So let's walk through, if you wouldn't mind, the differences in the House bill and the Senate bill. You're going to have to, you know, reach a compromise at some point between now and sine die. But what do you see as the main differences between the two bills, both of which we should reinforce were passed by overwhelming margins?
So certainly in the there are a lot of places where both bills are similar in significant ways. And I'll say, to begin with, the oversight part of the legislation is one area where there's a lot of agreement between the House and the Senate, and I believe we'll be able to take care of any smaller changes that need to be made. The remainder of the bill addresses how we address 10-year-olds who commit crimes that they're not felonies, but they're not nothing. And they're kids who are found in possession of firearms, kids who commit what's a third degree sex offense, where a person uses violence and has sexual, not a sexual act, but a sexual contact with another person, where there's animal abuse, or where there is, in the fourth case, cases where 10 to 12 year olds are involved in car theft. In the House, we felt it was important, and one of the themes that we heard from all of the, from a lot of different places, I should say, has been what's important is that you want to move kids through this system and get them closer to services faster. And so when it came to the 10 to 12 year olds, we put them into a diversion program that could be identified by police officers immediately. The Senate went in a different way where they rely on an existing system, which is called the Child in Need of Services system. And I think the House has some real concerns about the effectiveness of the Child in Need of Services system, in that we've got data that has demonstrated that in different parts of the state, people use it, don't use it. It's unclear that people truly understand how to use it. And what is pretty clear all the way across the state is that kids fall through the cracks when they're placed into that system. There are several other differences between the House and the Senate, but I'm not sure we are quite as far apart as it may seem at this point.
And in terms of the timetable, what's it look like for getting together with members of the Senate to work out the differences?
I think, well, right now we're in crossover week, so we have to pass bills that need to get to the other side by next Monday. And so we're in the midst of that. We've already passed the juvenile bills on both sides. So the focus will come back to the juvenile bills after next Monday, when we'll be able to focus on those pieces of legislation again.
How do you respond to those in the activist community, even the child psychology expert community, who say that some of these measures criminalize children, particularly these really young ones, these kids from ages 10 to 12. How do you respond to that particular critique?
I think it's the most challenging part of juvenile law. And as somebody who was on the Juvenile Justice Reform Commission and then, or council, and now is, and was chair then, chair now, we struggle with what to do with some of these the youngest children. There are a couple things that come to my mind. One, part of what is important, I think, is looking at the services the Department of Juvenile Services actually provides. People talk about, you know, not wanting kids to get system involved. I don't see them asking for the Department of Juvenile Services to be dismantled. The reality is there is a role for DJS in serious cases, and I believe that there are people at TJS who have the experience, particularly now, to provide those services to people, and they are getting their legs under them, and they may be able to come forward and show people and give people greater confidence in the larger community that services can be provided to these 10 to 12 year olds to turn them in a different direction. But I do wrestle with the argument that we should not ever get kids involved with any part of the juvenile system, while at the same time saying that the juvenile system is wholly sufficient in many other cases to deal with their problems.
Delegate Luke Klipwinger joins me. He is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. We're talking about juvenile justice reform and the legislation that's in front of both the House and the Senate. They both passed bills, and after next week, they will begin to figure out how to come up with a single measure that can be sent to the governor's desk. Governor Wes Moore just told me yesterday, I guess, that he intends to sign the bill, and he's really leaving it in your hands, Delegate Klipwinger. And I wonder, when you talk about the impact on the Department of Juvenile Services, the Department of Legislative Services issued a report analyzing the impact it would have on not only the kids who might fall subject to these laws, but also that, you know, DJS itself. Are you at all concerned about their concerns, saying that this will greatly increase the involvement, the intake activity, particularly for these little kids, 10 to 12 year olds, as well as for older juveniles. This comes from their report. They expressed some concern that DJS is going to be, their staff is going to be more stressed because of this legislation. Do you have concerns in that regard?
So the report that you're looking at, the fiscal note, was written prior to making the amendments that we made in the House and similar amendments in the Senate, which should address the issues with regard to the intake process. We included language in the initial version of the bill that would require police officers to file reports in every time that they arrest a juvenile. We've refined that language, so we're not asking DJS to act on every single one of those reports. And there are a lot of times the police officers arrest and they don't want DJS to go forward. So we've taken those out. That has dropped the burden on the intake side of for DJS. And then outside of that, especially with regard to the youngest kids, I think there is a misconception out there, and it's been a misconception that's shown up in writing in several places, that this will mean that 10 to 12-year-olds will somehow wholesale be placed into detention. The department already has the ability to use discretion in these cases. And in the bills as they stand right now, using the department's existing standards, the department has the ability to effectively keep 10 to 12-year-olds from being detained, particularly the one set of cases where you could possibly see detention would be when a child was in possession of a firearm. And I have many examples of where the Department of Juvenile Services has decided not to put kids into detention for being in possession of a firearm. So then adding on top of that, the number of those cases for 10 to 12-year-olds is relatively small. I believe that we're going to be able to put guardrails around the existing system. We're already putting more resources into the department. And with all of that and robust oversight, I think we're going to be able to give people more confidence that the department is working and that our juvenile justice system is working better.
Do you, and would you say the members of your committee, the House Judiciary Committee, have confidence in the ability and capacity of Vincent Schiraldi, the head of the Department of Juvenile Services? There are a lot of folks who think that he's, to some extent, been made a scapegoat in this conversation because of some media coverage of some particular incidents in which DJS has fallen short. There's a person at DJS who's been dismissed, et cetera. Are you confident in Vinnie Schiraldi?
I believe that he, having started about a year ago, I think he has begun to wrap his arms around the agency. He's finally, and I say finally, it's challenging. It's been very challenging, I think, for him and for anybody who's going to run a new agency to find those deputies to put in place to actually do the day-to-day operations at the department. He has some big ideas for what he wants to do there, but he also has an agency where the morale of the people who work there could not be lower. And so he has to try and figure out how to, in a different context a couple of years ago, fly the plane midair. He has to figure out how to fix some of those problems while ensuring that services are being provided well and services are being provided by a staff that gets clear direction as to what they're supposed to do. I think he's started to take some of those steps. I'm in regular contact with him. I want to see how he continues to attack those problems before I go into whether he should stay or he should go.
Delegate Luke Klippinger represents Baltimore in the General Assembly and chairs the House Judiciary Committee. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Up next, we continue our conversation about juvenile justice with Judge Andre Davis, a retired federal judge, prosecutor, and Baltimore City solicitor. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, We'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the show, our series of conversations with the candidates continues with Johnny Olszewski Jr. He's in his second term as Baltimore County Executive, and he's running for Congress in the Democratic primary for the District 2 seat that is currently held by Dutch Ruppersberger. He's announced that he's retiring at the end of his term. Johnny O. will join me tomorrow on Midday. And if you've just joined us today, we're talking about legislation in this year's General Assembly in Annapolis that concerns the juvenile justice system. My next guest is Judge Andre Davis, who has had a distinguished legal career as a judge at the federal, state, and local levels. After retiring from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2017, he served as the Baltimore City Solicitor until 2020, an act of civic dedication and generosity that is unequaled in the history of our city. And last week, Judge Davis and Nancy Gertner, a retired U.S. District Judge from Massachusetts, wrote an essay in the Baltimore Banner entitled "Juvenile Sentencing Bill is About Politics, Not Reducing Crime." I spoke with Judge Davis yesterday afternoon. Your Honor, welcome back. It's always good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you, Tom.
So you make a point in the essay that you wrote with Judge Gertner from Massachusetts that the politics of crime bears very little or no relation to the reality or the evidence when it comes to fighting crime, particularly juvenile crime. What do you mean by that?
Among other things, Tom, what we know to be true is that, unfortunately, when it comes to profit-making media, when it bleeds, it leads. And that's true in both broadcast media and, unfortunately, in growing outlets of the print variety. And so when media are undertaking to sell clicks and additions, crime plays just an incredible role, and the perception of crime historically has always been disconnected from the reality of crime. And so what we found very disappointing in the Maryland effort in particular is the disconnect between data that show crime across the board in many categories diminishing, and this effort to backslide, frankly, on some recent reforms that, frankly, haven't been given an opportunity to take hold fully. So it's a cry to policymakers and legislators to slow down, take a look at the data, at the growing science relating to brain development. And let's give our kids a chance to grow into healthy adults by giving them the support that they really need, not by increasing in their involvement in the criminal justice system.
I spoke with Governor Moore yesterday on the show, and when I asked him about this, the first thing that he mentioned was accountability, not just for the kids who are committing some of these crimes, but for the system or systems that are in place to help them and to try to, you know, divert them into a different path in life. How do you handle the notion? How do you perceive the notion of accountability? What are the metrics we should use for holding kids accountable, particularly when they're committing violent crimes, even though some of the ones who are doing this from time to time are very young children?
Yeah, it's so important, that word, accountability. And I don't fault the governor whatsoever or any of our elected officials for being really focused on that question. And as you suggest in your question, Tom, the issue of accountability crosses all the boundaries. Yes, young people, including really young people, must be introduced to notions of accountability as a part of their training, growth, and development. But our system has to be held accountable as well, as the governor rightly recognizes. And one thing that we don't see enough of, and I'm talking now for Judge Gertner and myself and others who share our views, is we don't see the policymakers and legislators demanding accountability from other elected officials and appointed officials to bring the services that have been promised, that everybody knows are desperately needed, to both young people and their families. And so, again, accountability is targeted at all actors, all stakeholders, all participants in the system. But let's not blame 11 and 12-year-olds for the failures of adults, including the adults who have primary responsibility for their well-being and nurturing, as well as adults in the system. And that includes elected officials who must be held accountable for what they know is needed to reduce involvement of young people in offending behaviors.
And the prosecutors, the criminal justice community, if you will, police, had a lot of problems with the bills that were passed in 2022. One of them had to do with the circumstances under which police could question children. It's called the Child Interrogation Protection Act. And the other piece of legislation back then, a couple years ago, was this Juvenile Justice Reform Act, which actually mandated that kids committing certain crimes couldn't be charged. They should not be criminally charged at all. And people saw that as a way of attenuating accountability for kids. They saw that as a way of avoiding consequences. The children were able to avoid consequences because they weren't going to be charged with a crime. How do you respond to that criticism of that legislation?
That's a very, very fair question, Tom. And I suppose I could give a multi-tiered answer, but I'm going to limit my answer to two aspects, one historical and the other more contemporaneous. You know, the very notion that juveniles commit crimes is itself a backslide. The entire, even before we had increased knowledge of brain science, which we have today, the whole notion going back to the 50s and even beyond the 50s, but certainly by the 60s, it was commonly understood that the whole mission of juvenile adjudications was that these young people, these juveniles, didn't commit crimes. Now, words matter. They committed offense behaviors. The word delinquent has become poisonous, admittedly, but the idea is that they weren't committing crimes in the way that we adults in the criminal justice system actually contemplate the behavior of an adult with mental capacity to form the intent and with the ability, if he or she uses it, to control their behavior in the moment. That's what we mean by criminal behavior historically. So now we've seemed to have moved beyond the real mission of juvenile justice to turn it into just another crime committed, only this time it's committed by a 12 or 13-year-old. And again, I want to emphasize, words matter because words structure the way we think about what we need to do. Now, prosecutors and police have a very important job in our society. And this is the second part of my answer to your question. Of course, they oppose certain reforms because, you know, it's a cliche that comes up far too often, but to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And to a police officer, And to a prosecutor, every offense looks like something that needs to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, and incarceration and probation are the answers. Well, those are not the proper answers for 11 and 12-year-old kids traumatized, as so many kids are, especially in our communities here in Baltimore, who need services and who absolutely do not need to be drawn into the criminal justice system, even that part of the criminal justice system that is referred to as juvenile justice. So yes, they oppose it. That's, frankly, that's expected. Few prosecutors get elected by promising the electorate that they're not going to lock up more people than their predecessors did. We have seen the pushback and the blowback against so-called progressive prosecutors in this country. And it's regrettable that that's happened. But we're talking here about 10, 11, and 12, and even 13 and 14-year-olds whose brain development, we know, has disabled them in very meaningful ways from making the kinds of decisions that will help them avoid involvement in negative activity. And that's the approach that we need to take. And on this question, by the way, Tom, of questioning juveniles, that's a classic prosecutorial police position. The police institutions around the country filed amicus briefs against the Miranda ruling in 1966. They opposed it strenuously. They said to the Supreme Court, if we can't question suspects, we'll be out of business. We won't solve any crimes. Well, Tom, the world did not come to an end. And frankly, the quality of justice in this country significantly increased with the Miranda ruling. And so all the law in Maryland and in other states protecting juveniles from the tactics used by expert interrogators in law enforcement is give young people the protection that they need, and the data absolutely supports such laws.
Retired Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Andre Davis is my guest. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about juvenile justice reform. So, Judge Davis, then, what are the services? What is the proper response to that 14-year-old? It doesn't happen a lot, but it happens every so often that a 14-year-old will point a gun at somebody and steal their car or steal other valuables on their person. What is the proper response? Because part of accountability in the adult system has to do with removing those people, removing those adults who commit those kinds of crimes from society and incarcerating them so that they are not a danger to anybody else. So how about those folks who say, hey, look, you know, if this child is acting as dangerously as an adult, that child needs to be treated like an adult, including taken out of society so that the rest of us are safer?
That's a very fair question, Tom, and I think that you are accurately channeling deeply flawed view of the matter that so many people in our community have. Tom, that 14-year-old who points a gun at somebody was once a third grader who could barely read at a first grade level. That 14-year-old was once in the fourth grade and could not read. And when you have, and the data absolutely is overwhelming on this, Tom, when you have especially black boys in the fourth grade who are not reading at grade level, the likelihood that that child will end up in the criminal justice system goes through the roof, well above 95%. So the answer that I'm going to give you, Tom, is a holistic answer. the services that that 14-year-old needs, he needs when he's 5, 6, 7, and 8 years old. And those services include providing him with mentors and so a support system, both in school and out of school. It includes providing him and his family with the support that they need to understand that life can be better than the circumstances that they face when he is in the fourth and fifth grade. And throughout his life, starting from the beginning and continuing through fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, the teachers and social workers and police officers, by the way, and other support systems in our society, in our community, we need more and better community schools. We need legislatures to devote the resources that are needed to treat substance abuse disorder, to treat trauma that so many of our children face. And we can't let politicians get away with, in all honesty, we can't let them get away with saying, oh, it's a 14-year-old with a gun. No, there are 13-year-olds with a gun, and there are 11-year-olds with a gun, not because they want to shoot anybody, but because they see what happens in their communities. And so it's a multifaceted problem, Tom, this issue of criminal involvement. And we need to be honest with ourselves, use best practices, embrace the knowledge of brain science that we are now imbued with, and we need to understand the effects of peer pressure on these young people. We need to understand the effects of trauma, and we need to flood our schools, particularly our inner city schools, with social workers and other support systems so that these young men, mainly young men, but also more and more young women, have the supports that they need. Now, once you encounter a kid with a gun, then yes, you need a strong juvenile services system to do everything possible, even when the person has a gun at 11 and 12 and 13, because most of them, Tom, are not looking to kill anybody. They are looking to protect themselves. And so we need a system in place that will come to that into that child's life to divert that child from becoming a 26-year-old inmate serving a 40-year or 50-year sentence. Now, that's the reality. We don't have all the time we need to fully explore all these issues. And I appreciate this opportunity that you've given me. Just, you know, I'm on this soapbox and I speak for a lot of people, but those are the hard truths that our political system and our community at large need to confront if we really want to deal with the effects of structural poverty, structural inequality, and the neglect and traumatizing lives that so many of our young people live to become a 14-year-old with a gun.
Judge Andre Davis, he is a retired Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals judge. And Your Honor, you're right. We don't have enough time to continue this very important conversation right now, but we will certainly continue it in the future. And I'm grateful to you for your time and perspective today. Thanks.
Tom, I'm grateful for the attention you're paying to these issues, and I thank you for this opportunity.
And we've got a link to the essay that Judge Davis co-authored in the Baltimore Banner on our website, wypr.org/midday. And coming up, we will continue our conversation about juvenile justice with James Dold. He's the CEO and founder of Human Rights for Kids. It's a nonprofit based in Washington. We'll hear his perspective on the other side of a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about reforms to the juvenile justice system that lawmakers in Annapolis are considering in this year's session. My next guest is James Dold, the founder and CEO of Human Rights for Kids, a nonprofit that advocates for human rights issues affecting children. James Dold joins us on Zoom from Washington, D.C. You can join us as well. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. James, welcome to the show. Thanks for your time.
Tom, thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So I know that you're familiar with Judge Davis because evidently you studied with Judge Davis in law school. Is that right?
That is correct. My third year, he was my criminal procedure professor. So very familiar with Judge Davis and his brilliant legal mind.
And what do you think about Judge Davis's observation that there is no such thing as a crime committed by a kid who can't understand what he's doing? He even, you know, mentioned that the word delinquent, we used to refer to children who got in trouble as juvenile delinquents. He says that's a problematic term. What's your take?
I think Judge Davis is spot on in that analysis. You know, when we look internationally, the U.S. is really the only nation in the world that prosecutes very young children. There's a human rights treaty known as the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Every single country in the world has ratified that treaty except the United States. And Article 40 of that treaty clearly spells out that nation states who are a party to it must establish a minimum age below which children are deemed incapable of transgressing the criminal law. And the Children's Rights Committee at the UN has specified that the minimum age should be 14 before a child, you know, can be arrested and prosecuted for crimes. And the idea is going back to the sentiments that Judge Davis talked about, which is that, you know, children, particularly the younger you go, simply don't have the ability to form mens rea. You know, we at Human Rights for Kids call it the Santa Claus test, right? If you have kids who have their baby teeth and believe in Santa Claus and fairy tales, you know, these are children who simply do not have the ability to form criminal intent in the same way that older adolescents or adults do. And that's really why, you know, we should be treating them differently. But at the intersection of that as well is, you know, how and why kids that young end up committing crimes in the first place, right? And Judge Davis also talked about this sort of the community and interpersonal traumas that so many of these young people are dealing with. And I highlighted this in a piece in the Baltimore Sun I wrote earlier this week as well, which is that when we really begin to peel back the layers of these children's lives, what we're finding is that overwhelmingly, right, they are victims of neglect. They're victims of criminal exploitation. And that so many of them have experienced significant childhood traumas before ever becoming involved in the system to begin with, which raises a much more important question for us as a society, which is that when we identify kids who've been physically abused, sexually abused, victims of neglect from their own families, where these kids are being exploited by older adult gang members or being recruited into gangs by gangs run by adults, you know, what is our response to those children? And I think one of the things that we really don't acknowledge as much in the United States is that we actually have a child soldier problem right here in Baltimore and throughout the United States, where we have children who are victimized, who are exploited, and then end up being recruited because these kids are looking for a sense of belonging and hope and protection. And older adult gang members realize that, and so that they exploit those children, making them victims of a form of human trafficking known as forced criminality or child soldiering. And so all of that sort of combined, the exploitation of these children, the vulnerabilities, their abuse and neglect, as well as the fact that developmentally, even if all of those factors weren't present, these children simply don't have the ability to form criminal intent, even under international human rights standards, all make the case for why we should not be criminalizing them and why we should be focusing on treatment and services instead of, you know, making, you know, the process harder to actually, you know, get them on the right path.
When you talk about forced criminality and gang members in particular, recruiting young children, particularly young boys, and most of these are boys of color, to commit criminal acts. And the reasons they say yes, the reasons they go along with this are varied and have to do with, as you say, neglect really bad situations at home. But give us a sense of the scope of that. I mean, is it almost all of the kids? Is it half of the kids who are doing this? What's the scope of the problem in that regard?
Yeah, so I'll give you my perspective, but I also want to highlight a couple of quotes from folks in law enforcement and prosecutors over the last couple of months, which, you know, gives their perspective on this a little bit. Last year, during a House Judiciary Committee hearing that was called by Chairman Clippinger, Delegate Sandy Bartlett asked the question of Mr. Clyde Boatwright, who's the president of FOP in Maryland, of how many of these cases of juvenile car thefts involve older adults who are basically exploiting children. And Mr. Boatwright mentioned that about 50% of all of the juvenile car thefts in the state of Maryland are the result of criminal exploitation by older adults. Last week, during
50%, 50%, so half.
And that's just the car thefts, right? Mm-hmm. And last week, Ivan Bates, you know, reinforced that sentiment. He said that, you know, there are individuals running around carjacking in groups of 3, 4, 5 cars a night, and there's a group of adults who prey upon juveniles to get them to do this type of activity, unquote. And so there's a recognition within law enforcement communities and amongst prosecutors that, you know, this is a very real issue where you have older adults who are exploiting children in this way. And to fully understand the scope of it, because, you know, much like most human trafficking, you know, we don't fully know the scope of exploitation that's happening. But I think what's important to highlight when we're looking at trafficking situations involving kids, right? One of the things that we look at to determine whether or not something falls within that category is the relationship between, you know, the victim and the offender. And in this case, you know, when we're talking about, you know, 10, 11, 12 year old kids or even younger, right? There's this huge power imbalance that exists between kids that young and the people who are running criminal street gangs, right? I think that there's this misperception out there about, you know, what gang leadership looks like nationally. But I can tell you that about 2/3 of all gang members in the United States are adults. And most of gang leadership is comprised of older men in their mid to late 20s to mid to late 30s, right? So you have this dynamic where people are recruiting and preying upon children in elementary school. You know, there was a infamous case last year of Jalen Richard, a young 12-year-old boy who was brutally murdered. And, you know, there was a misperception, I think, in the media about what was happening in his case because he was being coerced by older adults to sell drugs, you know, to engage in other gang-related activity. And instead of looking at him as a human trafficking victim the way that we should have been, right, he was just called a juvenile criminal. And this is nothing new also, Tom, I should mention. You know, for a long time, you know, girls who were being exploited in prostitution were looked at as just, you know, juvenile delinquents who were choosing to engage in, you know, that form of behavior. And as time has passed, we've come to learn, no, there's like a whole network, a whole system of control that pimps and traffickers were using to get those, you know, young girls to go out and engage in prostitution. And the same thing is true with young boys in criminal street gangs, right? There are rules that are enforced whereby, for example, if a child refuses to go out and carry out a drive-by or go out and steal a car or carry a gun, right, they are met with a form of physical violence, right, known as a violation. The gangs call them violations. And when you get a violation, what will happen is all the other gang members, at the direction of the older adult gang leader, will tell all the other members to beat, you know, the young child, you know, basically unconscious, right? So now you have this dynamic where these very young children are fearful of being beat up, of being killed, if they don't do what their gang leadership tells them to do.
And is one
right?
of the remedies is one of the remedies for that targeting statutes against people who are doing this coercion and this trafficking, and even statutes against parental involvement or disinvolvement, non-involvement, which leads to children that neglect that leads to children being susceptible to recruitment and manipulation by gang members. Is it a in your view is the way to approach this by statute telling parents, you know, you've got to be a better parent or else?
Yes, no, so absolutely, Tom, you're spot on. Last year, the General Assembly passed legislation known as Safe Harbor, right? And Safe Harbor was specifically targeted at child sex trafficking victims. And what it did is it prevents sex trafficking victims or children from being prosecuted for prostitution, as well as other nonviolent crimes associated with their victimization. Because there's a recognition that, you know, even girls who are forced into prostitution also are forced to commit other crimes at the behest of the trafficker. And so we need to look at this situation very similarly with young boys who are being exploited by criminal street gangs. First and foremost, we need to have a process that, number one, identifies and effectively screens for children who are being exploited in this way. And then the way we respond to, you know, the underlying criminal behavior must come from a victim-centered lens, where we make sure that those kids get treatment and services, and that we don't reinforce, right? This is a critical piece of this. We don't reinforce the narrative that gang leaders are telling these children, which is that, you know, law enforcement's the bad guy, that prosecutors are the bad guy, that nobody cares about you, right? Because when you just prosecute those kids, when you make them feel like delinquents or criminals, they're going to run right back to the very people who are exploiting them. And that's why it's critical to have a victim-centered response for kids in these situations. And then to your last point, yes, we support harsh mandatory minimums, right? And harsh sentencing for adult gang leaders who are exploiting children in this way, right? So we need to increase criminal penalties. We need to help law enforcement better go after adult criminal street gangs who are trafficking children in this way. Because if we don't, we're never going to end this cycle of violence, because there's always new, young, vulnerable children for these older adults who are savvy at interacting in the criminal justice system to exploit. So we need to bring the hammer down on older adult gang leaders. And then we also, to your other point, need to make sure that we're holding families accountable. And the way that we can do that is very simple.
And we need to finish up here in about 15 seconds. Uh-huh.
Absolutely. So the best thing that lawmakers in Annapolis can do is, instead of using delinquency petitions, use sins petitions, which allow courts and the judges to actually have jurisdiction over the child.
And sins
as
is
well
CINS, which is Children in Need of Services. And we are going to have to leave it there. Of course, a number of people in the activist community also talking about these gang members themselves who were victims of neglect as children and the problems of over-incarceration. Of those black men who are doing some of this activity, you know, becomes another issue. But we'll have to talk about that a little bit later. James Dold is the founder and CEO of Human Rights for Kids. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest will be second-term Baltimore County Executive Johnny Olszewski, Jr. He's running in the Democratic primary for the 2nd District Congressional seat that's currently held by Representative Dutch Ruppersberger. Yeah, Here and Now is coming up after news at the top of the hour, so stick around. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.